Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, sad commentary on the state of comedy. That a guy with no acting experience who makes electric cars can walk onto the set of Saturday Night Live and steal the show. That's what happened with Elon Musk's much anticipated turn at hosting Saturday Night Live on Saturday night amid the criticism, some snarkiness from cast members on Twitter because he doesn't hew to all of the left-wing orthodoxy. Some of it, but not all of it. This was Musk's, a part of Musk's opening monologue and his history-making hosting of Saturday Night Live.
Sometimes after I say something, I have to say I mean that. So people really know that I mean it. That's because I don't always have a lot of intonation or variation in how I speak. Which I'm told makes for great comedy. I'm actually making history tonight as the first person with Asperger's to host SNL. Or at least the first to admit it. So I won't make a lot of eye contact with the cast tonight. But all right, I'm pretty good at running human in emulation mode.
At least he's long on self-awareness, something else you don't see much from comedians and other celebrities these days.
To anyone I've offended, I just want to say I reinvented electric cars and I'm sending people to Mars in a rocket ship. Did you think I was also going to be a chill, normal dude?
I thought he did a great job. It was entertaining.
Especially by comparison.
Exactly. I mean, who was on last week? I don't even remember their name, but I'll remember Elon Musk.
No, I'm talking about by the comparison to the cast.
Oh, yeah.
How lame that cast is. How lame that show is. Why? Because they've become political activists rather than comedians. They don't push the boundaries like comedians from a bygone era, which is what you want.
No, they have a political agenda.
This is not exactly your George Carlin type of comedy, Saturday Night Live. I mean, just in terms of attitude. Or even going back to Saturday Night Live. I mean, obviously Carlin made many appearances on Saturday Night Live, but your great casts of your Dana Carveys and Phil Hartmans, Jim Belushis and so on and so forth. It's just not the same. The sketches are terrible. I watched a little bit of it just because Musk was on, and so you want to see how this guy does. Like, what is he? Is he now the second richest man in the world? Or first, he and Bezos.
Is it they go back and forth? Yeah. I don't know.
And you know, I'm very sort of mixed
about Gen Z General Hospital. Did you watch that one?
Yeah, it was painful.
Oh, yeah.
I'm mixed on Musk because you know he doesn't exist without being a rent seeker. He doesn't exist. Tesla doesn't exist. SpaceX doesn't exist without all of the taxpayer subsidies he gets. So I don't like guys that built empires based on the forced extraction of other people's money. So, you know, there's that aspect of it. I know that's inconvenient in this era of where everybody gets payoff. But Musk was sort of ahead of the curve on that, and it's served him very well. I don't know that ultimately the story will be that it served us very well, the taxpayers who were forced to underwrite Musk's ventures in significant fashion. So there's that, too. I like to try to tell as much of the story as we can, if not the entire story. But
I do give him credit during the pandemic, and he opened up his plant in California. Didn't care what the government said, no, we're going back to work, and I'm going with them. And if anybody gets arrested, arrest me first.
Yeah, well, that's why he's been chastised by the left, is because he didn't stick with the leftist lockdown orthodoxy, and he moved at least a part of Tesla to Austin and so on and so forth. Yeah. One good, I guess it was sort of a sketch, you know, his appearance in character on Weekend Update as financial expert Lloyd Ostertag talking about cryptocurrency. This was kind of funny.
What are cryptocurrencies?
They're a type of digital money, but instead of being controlled by a central government, they're decentralized using blockchain technology. And lately, prices have been soaring for cryptos like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and especially Dogecoin.
Oh, right. Now, what is Dogecoin?
Well, it actually started as a joke based on an internet meme. Mm-hmm. But now it's taken off in a very real way.
Okay, but what is Dogecoin?
Well, it was created in 2013 and has a circulating supply of 117 billion coins, of which 113 billion have already been mined.
Right, cool. So what is Dogecoin?
Yeah, like I said, it's a digital currency.
Like, okay, for instance, this is a dollar, right? It's real.
Say sorta. Yeah, sorta, okay. Real.
Yeah. Sorta real.
So
right.
What is Dogecoin?
About as real as that dollar.
Now, Colin, are you making any sense of this?
Me? Well, I've actually been reading a lot about it, yeah, and I'm trying to diversify my investment portfolio. Mm-hmm. My question is, what is Dogecoin?
I'm glad you asked.
It's a good question.
Well, it's a future of currency. It's an unstoppable financial vehicle that's going to take over the world.
I get that, but what is it, man?
I keep telling you, it's a cryptocurrency you can trade for conventional money.
Oh, so it's a hustle.
Yeah, it's a hustle.
Why did you say that, man?
Yeah, it's a hustle. And Dogecoin dropped after he jokingly referred to it as a hustle. You got to be careful. When Elon Musk speaks, the market reacts. We're going to have our friend Scott Diamond, the cryptocurrency expert on the Sausage King of Chicago, back on to update us on Doge and Ethereum and Bitcoin and who's still winning the cryptocurrency race and help us answer the question, what is Dogecoin?
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity this afternoon at 2 on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Remember Calgary pastor Arthur Pawlowski? This was a clip of him from Easter that went viral when Calgary, Alberta police showed up to his church, street church in Calgary, because he was running foul of the Canadian COVID strictures, and he shamed them out of his church. You remember.
Please get out. Get out of this property. Immediately get out. Get out of this property immediately. Out. I don't want to hear anything. Out of this property immediately. I don't want to hear a word. Out. Out. Out of this property immediately until you come back with a warrant. Out. 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 Out of this property. Immediately out. Immediately go out and don't come back. I don't want to talk to you. Not a word. Out of this property. Immediately out.
And they sheepishly left the property.
And there was like 12 of them all masked up, trying to take over. I mean, I don't know what the heck is going on in Canada, but how people are putting up with it, I don't understand.
Well, the Canadian version of the Stasi got the last word, at least the next word. They did get an order. So don't come back here unless you have a warrant. Well, now we got a warrant. The Alberta Health Services obtained a Court of Queen's bench order that applies to gatherings, including protest demonstrations and rallies. And because there are no First Amendment protections in Canada, like we have here with respect to freedom of religion, that would include church gatherings, too. So Arthur Pawlowski and his brother David arrested and charged with organizing an illegal in-person gathering, according to Calgary Police Service in a statement they released. Now, Pawlowski anticipated that he would be arrested because he was going to continue hosting services at his church, regardless of what the police state was ordering. This is the message that he recorded for just such an occasion as occurred over the weekend when everybody was having a good time watching the Vax Live concert, and yeah. Arthur Pawlowski and his brother were being dragged through the streets of Calgary in handcuffs.
Hello, friends. This is Pastor Arthur Pawlowski. If you're watching this video, that means they have successfully arrested me and I am in jail. If you would like to support me, if you would like to support Rebel News and the legal team that is trying their best to get me out of this trouble, please go to safearthur.com. Please donate. Please help. Help me. Help my family. Help my wife and my children to get me out of this horrible, illegal situation. Please go to safearthur.com and get me out of this if you can.
Rebel News, this outfit, you can follow them on Twitter. This is where I got some of the clips they posted, including a jailhouse interview of Pawlowski. They according to Rebel News, the authorities have not let Pawlowski yet talk to his attorneys, but they apparently did let him have a phone conversation with Rebel News, and here's what he said about the day and a half he had spent in jail as of yesterday afternoon.
Well, here's what happened after the video. I was thrown like a piece of meat behind a police vehicle, and I had to go for about an hour, hour and a half, back of a police car, laying down on my my handcuffs. So I have bruises all over the place. Almost broke my my shoulder. So that was until we got to Spy Hill. Then, of course, the processing unit with my brother, we were taken to two different separate cells. They're not allowing us to sleep. So 24 hours, I can't sleep. The lights are so bright. It's absolutely crazy. Even though other inmates, for example, across from my cell, they turned the lights off and he could go to sleep. I don't have that same courtesy. We do not have blankets. We do not have pillows, nothing. We had to spend the whole day yesterday and the whole night and half a day right now on a cold concrete. So that's the situation here. I was never contacted by a lawyer. Yeah, it's shocking. The treatment, I'm being viewed here as a monkey in a circus. From time to time, police will come and just look through the window, or, you know, like a trophy. But I'm in a good spirit. I'm not going to quit. I was handcuffed, rafted, thrown like a piece of meat behind the police van and taken to jail where I'm standing because I can't even sit anymore. You know, how long can you sit and lay on the concrete? So I'm walking around the cell waiting for my release so I can file my lawsuits against those people, because that's what I want next. I want to start going after those villains. They're villains. They're wicked, evil people.
Are you surprised it's come to this? Would you be surprised if it came to this in this country? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I mean, he's just trying to spread the word of the Lord. And he pointed out a good thing, like Walmart's open right now, and hockey teams are still playing, but you can't come in here and pray? What about giving people choices? If they choose to recklessly endanger their lives by going to church, that's their choice. Enough, right? We've been doing this for more than a year. Shame on them. The way they're treating him doesn't sound very Christian-like either.
We've highlighted these similarly hypocritical regulations throughout the COVID lockdowns in this country with respect to how religious institutions were treated as compared to commercial institutions. Mm-hmm. You had churches that had to go to court in places like California and the South to get relief, and they did get relief, but it was because the Supreme Court weighed in. The predilections of the politicians in these lockdown states, not that different from those in Alberta, I would argue. We talked about this last week. It was actually the subject of my townhall.com commentary. Cardinal George's statement near the end of his life in 2015, 6 years ago, that he would die in his bed, his successor would die in prison, his successor would die a martyr in the public square, and then his successor would pick up the shards of a ruined church and civilization and slowly begin the rebuild as has been done before. That seems to be the succession that we're on, to me. Maybe I'm overstating it. I don't know. And I also don't see people getting particularly exercised about these sort of really stunning infringements on people's religious liberties. I mean, I guess that's because less than half of Americans affiliate with a church these days. Yep. As we talked about, the lowest number in Gallup's tracking of this in 80 years. So we're becoming more secular humanists, so we don't care about these institutions so much. It's more important to me that Walmart is open than my church, maybe. The pastor, 35-year evangelical pastor in West London who was arrested last week, preaching outside of a transit station there, preaching Genesis 1 about the immutable nature of man, woman, and family. And that was treated as homophobic, his content, so he was arrested. Again, no First Amendment protections in Britain, like the UK, but here we have private institutions doing the state's work for them. So how much different is it really? How much further down the road are Canada and the UK really than the United States when it comes to religious liberty? And is this something important to you? Well, whether you're a religious person or not, you may consider that the real separation between free societies and unfree societies, two things really. One, free and fair elections, which is why all of the talk about election integrity is not to be dismissed, and freedom of religion, freedom of conscience. If you don't have those two things, you're not going to live in a free society. You won't have a free society. Whether you place importance on those things or not, you know, just do a little perusal of the world, maybe at present as well as, I don't know, the last 1,000 years, and tell me if you don't see those two aspects of civil society repeat themselves in free societies and be repeatedly absent in unfree societies.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Nation in Aurora, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. Anyway, no matter what is going on in D.C., but you see what is happening all over this nation, it is to bring a one world government, one world religion. And I want to say this in point, for these black people that are waiting for reparations, well, they have been on the plantation at the end of slavery, but they remain enslaved because they were given welfare, whatever, more food stamps. And that happened under Barack, the horse, Obama. They're not going to get what they have been waiting for or think that they're going to get. And as far as these young black men, it is not every black man. My sons have not been accosted by police as they step out. See, what they're trying to do with all of this violence and lawlessness, they're going to have people begging for the government to do something. And it will probably be UN police.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Nation. Back to Senator Cutt here. Something else that's happening in this country you may want to take notice of. Lockdown governors like Jay Inslee in Washington State. New guidelines for the incremental reopening. Religious and faith-based organizations with vaccinated-only sections are allowed to increase overall facility capacity to 50% in their whatever their phase two constitutes.
Three, tier five.
So are you going to go to church and sit in the vaccinated or unvaccinated sections? You want your churches to have vaccinated and unvaccinated?
Just like baseball?
Sections? Yeah.
In Dodger Stadium, and Cuomo's doing the same thing for the Mets and the Yankees.
That's interesting. I'm talking about
right.
A religious institution. I'm talking about an institution that's predicated on brotherhood. that you're coming together as a community. I'm not talking about a freaking baseball game.
So, I'm just saying that compare it. The government's telling you what to do at a baseball game. Now the government's telling you what to do at church.
So again, think about that. Think about the implication of segregated sections at your church based on COVID. And based on, frankly, the church adhering to the diktats of these politicians, these lockdown politicians. There are layers of problem to this. I just thinking about this, if this is important to you, and again, if faith is not important to you, it's fine. It's your choice as a free American. But if you desire to be a free American, you may want to think about involving yourself in this battle. Because, again, freedom of conscience goes, so do the other freedoms, starting with those enshrined in the first two amendments. Marty in Naperville.
Good morning. Great show, guys, as usual. Two things. One, on church now. I go to Belmont Bible Church in Downers Grove. There's no restrictions. You want to wear a mask, you don't wear a mask, it doesn't matter. It's all wide open. Second of all, we have a couple who moved to Canada, Calgary, in fact, because her husband was in the oil business, got transferred probably 20 years ago. At first, they were against everything the Canadian government was doing. Now, if the Canadian government tells them to go jump off the Canadian Rockies, they will do it. They say, well, we can't wait 2 weeks we get to see our granddaughter because we get a one-hour reprieve to drive. They can't, apparently, they can't go to the store. You have to have a purpose to go somewhere, or the police can just stop you and tell you go home. And these people just do it. I mean, they've assimilated to this thing like you wouldn't believe, and I just don't get it. So,
thanks for the call, Marty. The reason totalitarian governments from time immemorial have used propaganda and those inclined to totalitarianism is because it works. It's because it works on wide swaths of the people. And so haven't we seen that be the case again during COVID? Tom in Blue Island.
Dan and Amy, good morning. Great topic. This happened a month and a half ago, and this pastor shagged those status bureaucrats out without relent. And the tip of the spear was what's driving today's America, middle-aged white woman, refused to shut up, all she was asking was for them to have a warrant. And he just asking them to get out and get out. And yeah, he was yelling. And was he impertinent? Yes. But the church has been horrible throughout this whole pandemic. I was raised a Roman Catholic to respect a pope in Rome who's as much a politician as any of these bureaucrats. The church is their biggest enemy. The idea that the state was ever going to let this guy shag them out of there and they weren't going to come and get him, this guy's days were numbered his days were numbered as far as a free man once he shagged them out of there on video.
Thanks, Tom. John in Bridgeport.
Real quick, a couple weeks ago, Amy, a priest from your neck of the woods, gave a great homily and said that if Mother Teresa and Pope John Paul II had Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts in today's day and they were alive, chances are they would be banned. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, interesting thing this weekend at Mass, during the homilies, there was a family there, and the pastor was talking about how the church had these trips down to the border during a few years ago to see the injustices done to the children and just the problems with the whole immigration system. Which, you know, I can see. But the thing that struck me after Mass and the thing that me and a couple of people talked about, I don't see anything from, not just from the local parish level. I'm not talking about that because we discussed that and there's a problem and we admit that. We don't see anything about the church. We don't see anything from the diocese. I don't see it. Maybe I'm being hypercritical, but I don't see it. And I would think that most people would believe that the problems at the border now are far greater than what they were a few years ago. And I just, it bothers me it bothers me about the selectivity of what we want to protest against and what we don't as an institution. And if the church wants to go vaccinated, not vaccinated, I'll find another church. I can pray to God outside four walls. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Has the Republican Party at the national level become a circular firing squad over this effort that is afoot that may culminate on Wednesday to remove Liz Cheney from leadership and install Elise Stefanik as her replacement? That's what Maryland Governor Larry Hogan had to say on Meet the Press over the weekend with that yapping little terrier, Chucky Todd.
It just bothers me that you have to swear fealty to the dear leader or you get kicked out of the party. It just doesn't make any sense. Well, it's sort of a circular firing squad where we're just attacking members of our own party instead of focusing on solving problems or standing up and having an argument that we can debate the Democrats on some of the things that the Biden administration is pushing through.
Is that where the Republican Party is? You have to pledge fealty to dear leader Trump or you get drummed out of the party, as Larry Hogan contends. 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA turnkey.pro text line.
Or just, do you need a united front? I mean, Kevin McCarthy said, you know, we need a conference that's united, and that's why he's supporting Elise to replace Liz Cheney. And yeah, the Democrats are all over this. You know, Biden was speaking to President Biden last week. Oh, the Republicans are, you know, disarray. There's infighting. And they love that. They jump all over this.
Of course they do. And this has been, every hour on the 15s on CNN because, yes, of course, this is about projecting discord where not that much actually exists. Oh, the indignities a Mitt Romney or an Adam Kinzinger or Liz Cheney have to suffer with censure motions from local parties in their states and or their districts and primary challenges and curt words from a former president. Oh, heavens. Oh, it's so terrible. The party is melting down. Is it really?
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 64636 type in DA. Then a quick comment. You know who should also go? Adam Congressman Kinzinger on Face the Nation talking about the insurrection again. It's over. I mean, I don't know what his end game is, but it's enough already.
The party rises or falls with who's the conference chairman, number three in the party structure. And how many people even know that, even pay attention to this? Liz Cheney has profile. Adam Kinzinger has profile from the left media because they voted to impeach the president.
Right.
Mitt Romney has profile because he voted to convict the president. That's all. And that's, 10 members of the House and a handful of members in the Senate. And because people disagree with them, this is a circular fighting squad and the party's the Titanic and all of this other hysterical nonsense from the Larry Hogans and Adam Kinzingers of the world? I don't think so. In point of fact, the Republican Party is primed, positioned to take back the House next year based on the census, no matter how questionable some of those census numbers are, based on the census alone and the redistribution away from blue states like Illinois and to red states like Florida and Texas and Tennessee. The Republican Party at the federal level is the Titanic. They're in a 50-50 in the Senate. They're five sheets they need to swing in the House, and they're well positioned both in terms of the political landscape and what Biden policies are doing to this economy and culture, combined with the census redistribution, tracking people's move away from dying blue states to growing red states. And so we're supposed to believe the Chicken Little routines that you see on the Sunday talkies from Kinzinger and Hogan? No, I don't think so. And by the way, this is no like ringing endorsement of Lee Stefanik. I think she's a child. And she voted against the tax cuts. I mean, I'm not looking to Lee Stefanik to be some guiding light for the Republican Party.
She's third in line.
Don't really care.
Yeah.
It's Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise's show in the House. And those backbenchers that have some prominence, I mean, they're not really backbenchers when you're talking about the Jim Jordans of the world and so forth. You know, they'll continue to prosecute the conservative case. I suspect the House Freedom Caucus will continue to prosecute the conservatives' case, largely. Not that I agree with them on everything either, but largely they'll continue to prosecute that case.
And Cheney's constituents are going to decide whether or not she can continue as a lawmaker in D.C.
Yeah, of course.
I mean,
and so will Kinzinger's. So we should get into this big deal and take their bait to make this some sort of litmus test? What are you talking about? You have to pledge fealty to Trump. I haven't pledged any fealty to Trump. What are you talking about? You have to pledge fealty to Trump. Right now, DeSantis has surpassed Trump as the Republican Party's preferred candidate to be their presidential nominee in 2024. And that distance will probably increase over time as DeSantis wins re-election next year, as he continues to receive the benefits he deserves from the leadership he provided during the pandemic at the local level, the state of Florida. And you continue to compare and contrast how Florida has performed versus all of these lockdown states. And Abbott in Texas, to a large extent, too, is in that camp, and others. Nome in South Dakota. But, I mean, all this, you have to do this so you get drunk. Who's getting drummed out of the party? President Trump is supporting Stefanik over Cheney. So is Kevin McCarthy. So what? It's a leadership post within the party. They're not saying she should be removed from the House, unlike the left does when they have a Republican who disagrees with them. Or they disagreement altogether. And frankly, some of these surrender Republicans, these never Trump Republicans, are sort of half a click away from that position. So the Trump supporters are instituting some orthodoxy, you must do this or you get ousted and so on and so forth. Oh, it's just a bunch of silliness. It's fodder for, you know, mindless Sunday talk show hosts that are just there to parrot the lines for the left. Don't buy into it. They'll walk away from it. We have people want to raise this as some sort of, this is a moment, this is some, you know, determinative event in the future of the Republican Party. Liz Cheney or Elise Stefanik on Wednesday. No, it's not. It's not. Maybe it's the Republican Party self-policing a little bit, which is a good thing. And that's about it. And they've got a lot more self-policing to do. Justin in Cedar Lake, here on Chicago's Morning Answer. Cedar Lake, Iowa.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy.
Iowa, Indiana.
Hey, guys, a little off topic.
Are you
can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can. Are you in Cedar Lake, Indiana?
Yep. Driving on the Skyway to the city for work now, but question for
be
you guys.
Careful.
I mean, maybe you talked about it, maybe you haven't, I'm not sure. But the audit in Arizona that's going on with the election right now,
All
kinds of news coming out of there about all the fraudulent votes and everything, but you can't, no one's reporting on it. You guys got a take on that?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Justin. Actually, talked about it on Friday with John Cass a little bit, and what I understand to be true from somebody who I know who's pretty close to what's going on there. There's not much reporting on it because there's not much concrete to report there. But there is still moves going on, by the way, on the front, the election integrity front there. Ducey, governor there, signed a law banning voters from adding signatures on unsigned ballot mail-in ballots after Election Day. That's new in Arizona.
Wow.
And
know that.
But I mean, the whole idea of, you know, the curing ballots, and some jurisdictions allowed you to, and it wasn't just in Arizona, but other places too, and some didn't, and it created this mess. So, I mean, these are real substantive efforts that are afoot, legislation that has been signed into law by governors in places like Georgia and Florida and Arizona. But in terms of Maricopa County and that audit, we'll have to wait and see. But I mentioned on Friday that I heard Maricopa County, there were 214,000 adjudicated ballots, meaning it was not clear initially on the computer read, who the person voted for. and to expedite, this is what I understand to be true, to expedite that the counting and the adjudication of those ballots, the Dominion system has a batch adjudication function. And so you can adjudicate, you know, in mass, and that batch adjudication function will default to a ballot position when it comes to a mark. This is not saying it will default. You can program and say, make all the votes Biden, make all the votes Trump. No, it will default to a ballot position with respect to a mark. And so what I am told is that there are a number of ballots that were batch adjudicated. And this was also not uniform in Maricopa County. Some judges did it and some precincts and others didn't. And this, you still need to get a handle on this. So the audit is ongoing. And but the batch adjudication process led to thousands, maybe tens of thousands of votes being counted for Biden that on human inspection should have been Trump voters. It was more obvious that they were trying to vote for Trump, not Biden. And so you're talking about, I mean, the numbers that I heard, potentially, if you take away those votes that went to Biden that shouldn't have and put them to Trump where they should have belonged, there is some suggestion, estimated, that it would be enough to turn the election in Arizona. Now, it's not going to overturn the 2020 election, but this is this is all about prospective, so we don't have a repeat of what happened in 2020, in 22, and 24, and beyond. So that's one thing that is out there. I don't know if it's true. I'm telling you this rumor because I have somebody who's very close to it, who I trust, who's experienced in this realm. And I think there's more going on in terms of investigations in other states on the order of what you're seeing in Maricopa County that may come up with information, like irrefutable data, that suggests that there were problems elsewhere. And we should be open-minded on that. I'm not preordaining the outcome, but we should be open-minded about it because this is serious stuff, which is why there's serious reform legislation that's moving in state legislatures, those controlled by Republicans around the country, particularly in states that had problems like Arizona. And so that's where it's at. And for that position, which I just explained, to be lumped in with the big lie that political hacks doing the bidding of the left, Kinzinger and Cheney, two prominent examples, for that to be lumped in, you're not allowed to ask questions. You're not allowed to watch a process play out and see if there is material evidence to support the claim that there were problems that rise beyond the level of one-offs, that it could have been something that was, you know, maybe whatever your definition of widespread is, it was widespread enough that it was impactful in the outcome. Well, that's irresponsible. And it's interesting to me, the parallel. Who doesn't want you to ask questions? Who wants you to just repeat what they say is the conclusion? It's the lockdowners when it comes to COVID, and it's these surrender Republicans along with the lockdowners when it comes to the 2020 election. Anybody who doesn't want you to ask questions, doesn't want you to be open-minded as to the possibility of answers you didn't anticipate about things you don't know, is trying to sell you a bill of goods. Clay in Wheeling, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. A little fired up this morning, huh, Dan?
I try.
You know, say what you want about Trump, but he truly exposed all these weak, spineless Republicans. I think he truly helped bring these people to light. And you know what? Every Republican citizen just got two tokens at Chuck E. Cheese to play whack-a-mole by their votes. I say we start whacking these mold left and right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Clay. Appreciate that.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and I think it was with Cass on Friday. I'm trying to remember. I just sort of taking my position now as like the band on the Titanic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. You're going to go down, but you're going to go down plain.
Yeah, I'm just...
And refined and in a tux, of course.
No, the point is I'm just doing it for myself. You know,
oh.
I'm conceding we're going to sink and there's nothing I can do about it. So I'm just going to do what I do for my own personal enjoyment, like the band on the Titanic. And I think Van Morrison is in that camp, too. You know, Van Morrison and Clapton had that lockdown song,
oh, yeah,
anti-lockdown
song. It was good.
Yeah, well, Van Morrison is out with a new album, and he's got a Why Are You on Facebook song. Take a listen.
Why are you on Facebook?
Oh, my gosh, really?
Why do you need secondhand friends? Why do you really care who's trending? Or is there something you're defending? Get a life, is it that empty and sad? Or are you after something you can't have? You kiss the girls and run away. Now you won't come out to play. Why are you on Facebook? Why are you on Facebook? Why are you on Facebook? Why are you on Facebook?
You know, it's not Brown Eyed Girl, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, he's so hip. I mean, he's really with it. At his age, even knowing what Facebook is.
I'll post this on Facebook, and I better get at least 100 likes because I need the dopamine hits. All right, one more verse.
Did you miss your 15 minutes of fame? Or do you not have any shame? Or is it some kind of twisted game? Put yourself in the frame. What some people work very hard to attain. Or are you looking for a scapegoat to blame? Is you're a failure again? Why are you on Facebook? Why are you on Facebook?
Yeah, you think about that question.
Why are you on Facebook?
Think about that question.
I don't like Facebook. But I tweet, and that song's coming next week.
Stop bitching. Do something right now.
Oh, yeah.
Stop bitching. Do something
more
right
Van
now.
Morrison off his new album. Do they still call them albums? This is great. Anti-lockdown, anti-Facebook, anti-bitching.
Start doing something. Let's go.
I'm not the biggest Van Morrison fan, but just on the content alone, I'm going to have to.
He's growing on you.
Pick
I could
this
tell.
Up. Yeah, very good. All right, we'll keep I think he'd be fine if you use social media to promote his album, even though it's sort of railing against social media.
Yeah, why not?
All right. So over the weekend, John McWhorter, he is the linguistics professor from Columbia University. He's got a new book out. We're working to get him on the show. I've talked to him before. And he was on with Bill Maher, who's a total poser when it comes to critical race theory and the purchase general intolerance of dissent. I know he said some things that have been shared because of the platform that he has. But again, he has been as much a contributor to the culture we currently live under as anybody who dabbles in politics and has sort of celebrity-sized platform associated with him. But McWhorter was very good. He's very succinct. He's a very, very smart guy. The only thing I don't like about it, sometimes like false modesty, and you'll catch it in some of the clips that we play. There's no need for false modesty. It actually has no place here, especially when you're dealing with inferior intellects and charlatans like Robin DiAngelo and Ibram Kendi, who he mentions by name, at least by book title. So the reason McWhorter's comments you're about to hear are so important is not because he has a rapier-like wit and can decimate a charlatan like a DiAngelo or a Kendi, a.k.a. Henry Rogers, very quickly. It's because what he's destroying is in your kids' classrooms. This is in your corporate DIE sessions, diversity, inclusion, equity. These are the manuals that he's going after. So pay close attention. And maybe you want to take that John McWhorter clip or his interview with Marr. And maybe you want to show that to your teachers and your principals and your C-suite executives and whoever else, your professors. Maybe you want to show that to them and say, how about at minimum, you don't have to remove how to be an anti-racist. You don't have to remove white fragility. But how about you include not only John McWhorter's interview, but some of his work? And how about you include, as we've suggested before, you don't have to ban anything. Just include more work that challenges directly what is being celebrated by the education establishment, by Fortune 500 America, by the academy, by the arts and entertainment institutions. Yeah. How about this? This has great application. You don't have to be the bad guy now. You don't have to make the argument. John McWhorter will do it for you. All you have to do is cut and paste. John McWhorter, he's not being brave in his devastating critiques. And by the way, we've referenced them on this show as well. I've read excerpts of his takedowns, longer form takedowns in written form at Substack of both D'Angelo and Kendi. But he's not being brave. He's just making sense.
I don't think of myself as brave because what I really am is a failed lawyer. And my issue is just that if things don't make sense to me, then I just want to try to make sense of it and I want people to understand what I mean. And this is the thing. If you are a good black person, you're often told that when it comes to certain race issues, you're supposed to not quite make sense and that you're supposed to deal with a certain kind of word magic. I have never felt it. I've always thought I'm black and I would like that to make sense too. And that's why I end up looking brave when really I'm just obsessive. Well,
on being condescended to, which is really one of the main criticisms he levels and is appropriate, I level too, against these books, White Fragility and How to Be an Anti-Racist, and so much of the schlock from these leftist race hustlers being condescended to, a educated, intelligent black man does not like being condescended to any more than anybody else does, it turns out. What a surprise.
It's the strangest thing. Like, you read a book like, and yeah, we're going to have to be specific, White Fragility, which basically says that black people are these hothouse flowers where everybody has to tiptoe around us. And, you know, we're always crying and we're always angry. And we're just so very, very, very delicate. I don't feel like that person. That book is talking down to me as far as I'm concerned.
It really should be called Black Fragility. Right?
Yes, yes. It should be used to keep tables from wobbling. That is the only use for that book. And yet, you look on Facebook and you have people saying, I'm doing the work and reading this book. And I think to myself, they are doing the work of making me into a perfect idiot.
Right.
And yes, why don't more of my fellow black people feel that way? And it's because of a very human thing, which is that it is a very human thing to take on the victim identity. All people do it. We've all known people like that. A way you can do it, if you're a black person, and all of us need to grab onto something sometimes, is to read a book like that and think, yes, I need to be treated that way. And I am going to start actively parsing it that way, because I don't think people realize what silly babies books like that make us look like. So something needs to be said.
I'm doing the work. I love his ridicule of that line. That's right up there with hate has no home here. I'm doing the. You've seen this, and you hear this from politicians. These cant spewing politicians or academics. I'm doing the work, and picture of a book jacket that you're reading. Yeah, you're doing the work. I'm reading the manual I was told to read so that I can repeat it without having to think, so I can be absolved. The response to the condescension. And again, will you take this to your school, to your business, to your kid's professor and say, why not include him? Does he not have the credentials? Linguistics professor at Columbia? What is it about John McWhorter and, I mean, so many others, Shelby Steele, Thomas Sowell, Walter Williams, Bob Woodson, Glenn Lowry, et cetera, et cetera. Well, why can't they be included in the conversation? I don't understand. I'm not asking for some crazy white right-wing kook on the radio like Proft or somebody else on AM 560 to be included. No, no, no. Well, what about these academics? What about these black men and women of accomplishment who may or may not be saying the same things as some of these alleged right-wing kooks? But regardless, you want to challenge John McWhorter in terms of his bona fides to be in this conversation? But some white chick like Robin DiAngelo should go unchallenged? Or these pea hat wearing leftist women in the suburbs should go unchallenged? John McWhorter, sorry, you have no place in this conversation. Really? Are you that afraid? You won't even introduce alternative scholarship, actual scholarship, really, in the face of the flim-flammery you're getting from DiAngelo and Kendi, since they're at the top of the hustle pyramid. And so McWhorter goes on to make the point, you know, those books that all these white leftists say you should read that are part of the curriculum at so many institutions now and in so many DIE training sessions now, doesn't represent the views of the majority of black people.
Yes. I know when I say these things, it's not just me and Coleman Hughes and Glenn Lowry and two or three other people. If it were something like that, I wouldn't say, hey, look at the way we weirdos feel. It's that I've been black pretty much for 55 years, and I know how black people feel.
Right.
And I always think this certain sliver of people in the media and in academia, they're often much smarter than me, but that is not the representative view. And so, for example, if you're going to read How to Be an Anti-Racist, that is not the general black view of things. That should be read. It's like the Bible. That book, if you must read it, should be read as literature rather than as scholarship. That's not general. And yet we're told that somehow we have to accept these sorts of things as the black view. And you'll see it on Twitter. A black person will write on Twitter, you have to listen to the black people who are the real black people, the black people who black people listen to. No, no. There is a great deal of diversity in the black community, and I can tell you it is not the default in the black community to think of ourselves as pathetic. Yes, we can't has never been the slogan for black America, and it's not now.
Yes, we can't. Not the slogan for black America. That's a good line. By the way, the whole like us, people smarter than me in academia and media, that's why I'm talking about is false modesty. They're not, especially in media. Nobody in media is smarter. Nobody in media is smart for the most part. I'm sure there are a few exceptions. None spring to mind, I can tell you that. Yes, we can't. So why? Why are people afraid to bring this forward? You don't have to be the white privileged person saying it. Why can't we stand on the shoulders of people making sense like John McWhorter? Say, well, offer him up. Why not? I don't know. Why will people not bring these scholars forward? I don't understand. Why don't you bring him forward at CPS? You, Amy.
I'm barely hanging on to my job right now.
Okay.
I mean, it's true.
I mean, these people are out there fighting the fight. You say, you know, the collective view, so many people I hear say, you know, they'll do what they can. Is this not the minimum you can do is say, have you ever heard of John McWhorter? Have you ever... Go listen to Bob Woodson's most recent talk at Hillsdale College. Have you ever heard of Bob Woodson? Have you ever given him his views any consideration? He's been in the civil rights movement for 50 years. He spent his life trying to pull people out of poverty of all races.
He'd be far more effective than Reverend Jackson speaking.
Well, that's not even the point. It's not even the point of who's effective. Just present them. Why will you not read or listen to anything that this list of... I just named half a dozen off the top of my head. I could give you a list of 40 or 50 or 100. Why do none of these people matter? Why won't you listen to anything they say? Read anything that they have written? Why won't you do it? How difficult a question is that? I'm not even taking... Don't take a position. I just don't... You have to tell me why these people are banned. Because that's what you're doing. How does John McWhorter not get consideration, but Robin DiAngelo does? I don't understand. You can't put that to your principal, to your teacher, and I'm not, you know, it's not just parents, young people, your professor, your HR director, your CEO. You can't? I don't understand that. And frankly, I don't, at least I can't off the top of my head, come up with a good excuse for why somebody can't do that. Because I know it's happening everywhere. Every day, I get more and more of these instances, like the apologize for your whiteness class at Loyola Academy and Wilmette sent to me, from Catholic grade schools and Christian academies and so on and so forth. Companies. So if it's happening there, obviously it's happening where there is no pushback whatsoever in the government school systems. And in the outwardly, openly woke corporations in this country. So what's the problem? Ed in Oak Brook.
You know, Dan and Amy, a couple of months ago, I think it was February, they kicked Clarence Thomas's documentary off of Amazon or something like that.
Yeah.
And nobody even protested it. Right. Nobody in the woke or white or liberal, whatever you want to call them, jerks is what I call them. No one even protests. So how do you take these people serious? You know what? You can't. You just can't take them serious at all. And most of the corporations are afraid, and they don't have any backbone. If one starts standing up to them, I think all of them are going to start standing up to them. And it's not going to matter anyway. The economic is going to crash anyway. And all of this wokeness stuff is going down the river.
All right, thanks, Ed. Here's the thing. This isn't a group exercise. This is an individual exercise. Why will you not? Is there any reason why you wouldn't do exactly what I said? Present these scholars, some of whom I mentioned, many others, and say, what about including them when you want to tackle issues of race, economics, culture, the interplay of all three? Why can they not be included? You have to explain that to me. Why can't you press that issue in just that way?
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. AM 560. The Answer.
Quickly, Lee and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan. Wait a minute. Wasn't it the president that said that the Hispanic community is diverse, unlike the monolithic black community?
That's essentially.
Wasn't he also the same one that said you ain't black if you don't vote for me?
Yeah, that's the same guy. You have that guy right. I know, but it doesn't matter. Going after Biden, I don't think, is where you make your bones with respect to trying to continue to build on what Trump did in bringing more black Americans into the conservative ranks. I think it is challenging them with some of their best and brightest thinkers. That's what needs to happen.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we played a CIA recruitment video last week, all identitarian politics all the time from the CIA. This really inspires a lot of confidence about the CIA culture, and I understand when you have a red diaper baby like John Brennan as the head, that doesn't help, but...
she said she was a cisgender mom, which means she's the sex that she was born with at birth. Who can change a diaper in one hand and coddle a crying toddler with the other hand.
That was one of them. Here's the CIA librarian profiled in a recruitment video ad campaign the CIA is using online.
As an agency librarian, I work to ensure that our collection and services are matched up with what CIA needs. Not only am I involved in the acquisitions of journals, books, and countless electronic resources, I'm also encouraged to curate special collections that challenge expectation. Recently, I brought in our intelligence gaming collection to give officers unique opportunities to practice skills they need in their various roles. Instead of sitting for hours in front of a computer-based training, they can play a carefully selected game to train a specific set of skills while simultaneously building on the myriad soft skills essential to intelligence work. My favorite thing about CIA is that they encourage the out-of-the-box ideas that drive real progress. Growing up gay in a small southern town, I was lucky to have a wonderful and accepting family. I always struggled with the idea that I might not be able to discuss my personal life at work. Imagine my surprise when I was taking my oath at CIA and I noticed a rainbow on then-director Brennan's lanyard.
I bet you did. The first part of the ad was fine. He's talking about the role that he plays and how he aids the overall agency mission.
Yeah, that's.
But then you have to get into the sentimental identitarian backstory, which has what to do with my interests at CIA as a spy agency to advance our national security?
Don't care. Protect our country. Our enemies are watching these videos, guys.
A woman who is in the CIA's Protective Services Department.
I'm now part of the Director's Protective Staff, which provides armed security to principals under both CIA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. We've had several principals that were women, some of whom have asked why there aren't any more women on the Director's Protective Staff. I've been able to inspire not only women to pursue DPS, but also people who wouldn't normally consider themselves qualified to be a special agent. The truth is, I haven't learned how to find a balance between my work and personal life. My husband and I have tested the limits to this balancing act as full-time working parents to two young boys. DPS agents work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We travel the world, and we are unquestionably willing to put our lives at risk for the safety of another person for the greater purpose of national security. I am now a supervisory special agent held by only a handful of women in the past. I've experienced highs and lows, both professionally and personally.
I'll have. Okay. Look at me. I'm suffering. I'm a parent who works.
On
she's not an anomaly. Anomaly, excuse me.
Diversity and inclusion. The DIE checkbox.
I was hired to be a receptionist. It was my first position here. And I was so flattered and so stunned. I remember distinctly walking through these large hallways at headquarters and thinking, I can't believe they let me be here. You know, I can't believe that they're going to let me show that I can do a job, that I am a professional, that, you know, they're giving me a chance. So in that regard, I too want people with disabilities to know that the agency does hire. We all have different skills, abilities, and we can offer a great asset to the agency. I think doing that will make the agency an employer of choice. That is the director's goal.
And that's all well and good. I'm all for hiring people or not allowing somebody's disability to get in the way of their ability to do a job. But it's the obsession with identity and almost it's not that proficiency isn't mentioned in at least some of these recruitment videos, but it's definitely subordinated to identity. And that's at the CIA, as if the confidence in the CIA hasn't been shaken for at least half the country per its performance during the Russian collusion saga and per John Brennan's antics on cable news for the last 4 years, these recruitment ads. Again, it's also something, too. There's an interesting study that was put out recently comparing the two administrations, Biden and Trump, to this point. Biden administration hiring many more Dem activists. Trump administration actually played it pretty much down the line when it came to partisan or ideological affiliation, according to this study. Well, that's sort of a problem. The left hires the left, and then the right hires the left largely, too. And then you wonder how you lose control of institutions and they get far afield from their stated mission. For more on all this, pleased to be joined again by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And he's the author of the forthcoming book to be released May 21st, Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, great to be with you.
I know we mentioned this last week, but it persists, so we persist. And now, you know, in the context of things getting a bit dicier in Afghanistan with that bombing near the school, more violence escalating since we announced a withdrawal, the potential ouster of Bibi in Israel. You know, the world's getting to be a more complicated place. Spycraft, always important. And yet here we have CIA obsessing about people's personal stories and non-behavioral characteristics.
So we try to do a lot on intelligence, which is difficult because it's classified, right? So doing analysis on the intelligence community, intelligence operations is hard. Part of the way we do that is we work with people who are in the intelligence community, including one of my visiting fellows who's a retired director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. And so we, you know, ask them, what do you guys think about this? And to a person, I mean, they find this deeply disturbing, you know, as do I, as a military veteran. You know, I spent 25 years in uniform trying to convince everybody in uniform not to see anything but the uniform. That it didn't matter, you know, where you were from or your background or any of your other characteristics. You were judged on your service, and selfless service was your identity. These commercials and the CIA culture, which is being inculcated under political leadership, runs counter to that. And here's the deal: is this is something that is a political agenda. We see it in the Pentagon. It's not because, well, this is good for the force, or our studies say that, you know, diversity is better. None of that's true. This is a bunch of politicals who come in and say, we have an agenda here, and we want you to adopt this agenda, and you work for us, so you will do that. And people that work for them do that. Yeah, but it is, I think, destructive.
But if they're selfless service, I mean, why would they allow themselves as CIA employees to be exploited like that?
I don't know. I can't speak for them. I'm not sure people always understand, because look, you and I, we're going to Walmart. Mm-hmm. You know, we're taking the kids to school. We're not sitting back thinking about the greater implications of all of this, and we're trusting the people that we work for a large part. Hey, this is a good thing. Go do this. Okay. You're the boss. But the reality is they have an agenda. Their agenda is to reshape America. And things like traditional family are offensive to them. And it's not about diversity. If it was about diversity, I think we'd all be fine with this. It's about a different way of looking at America and Americans, and it's forced political transformation. And it is distracting from the mission of the force, and it is destructive, because we shouldn't be focusing on people's identity. We should be focusing on their abilities and their qualities.
Hate to break it to Amy here, since I know since she's a big Richard Engel fan, one of her favorite dumbasses that has a profile on NBC News. And I hate to break it to Richard Engel too, but
what?
The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists published a report by Nicholas Wade, who, by the way, is a science writer who's been on the staff of Nature Science and for many years the New York Times, just so we understand this isn't some, you know, right-wing cooked-up matter. Before COVID-19 ravaged the world, Fauci's National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases funded coronavirus research that included the work at China's Wuhan Institute of Virology, studied the virus's ability to attack humans. But this report, exhaustive report by Nicholas Wade in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, suggests that it is more likely than not that the virus originated from that Institute of Virology in Wuhan, not from the wet market, as Richard Engel and so many others
insisted,
in the D.C.
Yes.
press corps wanted us to believe. In addition to that, we have a document that was obtained by Sky News Australia, written by Chinese scientists and Chinese public health officials in 2015, that discussed the weaponization of SARS coronavirus, titled The Unnatural Origin of SARS and New Species of Man-Made Viruses as Genetic Bioweapons. That was the title of the paper. The paper predicted that World War III would be fought with biological weapons. This is in 2015. Jim, your comment on those developments in terms of source and perhaps motivation.
Well, both those documents raise a really interesting question, which is, why is the U.S. government funding any scientific research over which there is zero transparency, zero access, and zero accountability? I mean, is that not strike you as kind of an element of malfeasance there?
How dare you question this, Tony Fauci's judgment?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think it just raises really serious questions. I mean, they're not, I mean, regardless of the truth of what they're doing, they're not following acceptable scientific practice and protocol. Would you invest in a company that doesn't follow the fiduciary rules, you know, basic fiduciary rules? You would say, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, why would I incur that risk? Why is the U.S. government funding any scientific research that doesn't even meet international scientific standards of accountability, of responsibility, and of transparency?
Well, why were we paying for that lab in Wuhan, China? And whose decision was that?
Well, I don't know. I would suspect that, you know, for many years we had this ridiculously stupid policy towards China. Following the world's great expert on diplomacy, Blazing Saddles. You know, there's a character in Blazing Saddles. He's a big mean guy, and they don't shoot Mongo because you might make him mad.
Yeah.
And so our policy with China was like, don't make China mad. Let's find ways to work together. So let's throw money at things in China, and we did, including scientific research and joint cooperation and joint ventures and everything else. And the notion is this will make China a nicer character. But I think the fact that the Chinese were not playing by the rules, that you had no transparency over your money, no accountability for these activities, that should have been a red flag that this is not a responsible partner for the United States. And yet, we have that long history of utter failure. We see an administration that right now is replicating exactly the same thing with Iran. They're literally throwing money in Iran when we know for a fact that the Iranian regime is malicious, unaccountable, and not responsible.
Well, also, too, it's not just limited to the infectious disease space or even the nuclear space, as you're talking about, but just generally, it's just sort of part of the D.C. culture, it seems to me. A good piece in National Pulse about Tom Vilsack, former governor of Iowa, President Biden's Secretary of Agriculture, and his lobbying over the years for Chinese Communist Party projects. He lobbied, for example, for the China Garden Project, it's reported, $100 million, 12-acre arboretum paid for by the Chinese Communist Party, wanting to make ties between the U.S. and the Chinese Communist Party and the businesses they control closer, attracting people to the nation's capital, wonderful arboretum to have, living symbol of the relationship, all this business. Liz Cheney's husband is a partner at the D.C. law firm of Latham & Watkins. And they have on their website a Greater China practice, advising Chinese Communist Party linked technology firm Tencent, for example, on its investment in American companies and so on and so forth. You know, and that's I'm just picking out Liz Cheney. I'm not saying it's limited to her, or Tom Vilsack. This is sort of a cultural issue with how China, the Chinese communists, insinuate themselves by compromising elected officials or cabinet secretaries, directly appointed officials, or perhaps their spouses. It's very insidious, and I don't think it's taken seriously enough.
And we're very susceptible to it because, look, it's not just China. Look at the administration's plan for dealing with Latin America. They want to throw money at Latin America, and they don't care about how they're going to deal with the issues of corruptions or lack of infrastructure or anything else. They just think we can buy our way out of this. You know, I call this foreign policy by ATM. And when you deal with corrupt and malicious actors, it does make you incredibly vulnerable. And there's a lack of, you know, there's a lack of basic risk management here. It's like, dude, did you think about what you're doing? But it's like, I think it's a particular problem for this particular administration, which is adopting the very same pathologies of the Obama administration, which is we're going to throw money at bad people and hope that things work out, and they won't.
Speaking of the border, a deputy comms director for Biden, we had a plan from the beginning, move kids as fast as possible out of CBP to ORR and to the arms of vetted sponsors or family members. That plan is working. Byron York's translation on that. Oh, so the plan from the beginning was not to prevent illegal border crossings, but to accommodate them.
Yeah, hello. I think we've said that on this show for weeks, that their solution to the border crisis is to move more people into the country faster. And they're literally just playing a shell game. And now they are proud of the fact that they've fixed the border because they can move more people, illegal immigrants, into the country. And the problem is the more you move in, the more people will line up at the border to be moved in. And the more you promise amnesty, the more people think, I will move to America and they will let me stay. And this doesn't look, in addition to flooding the country with illegal immigrants, whether you like that or not like that, the cost you are buying for the American taxpayer is in the billions of physically doing this. It's going to cost the taxpayer in terms of hosting these people in the hundreds of billions. And in the process of doing this, the amount of money that you're pouring into transnational criminal organizations every day is astronomical. And essentially, we are building the new mafia. We are building the criminal enterprises that are going to destroy the public safety of America. And we are paying for it. We're paying for that. Taxpayers are paying for hosting illegal immigrants. And this administration considers that a check mark and a success.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. The book, which releases May 21st, so pre-order it, Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word APP to 64636 to download the app today. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And that jobs number on Friday that people are still wrestling with, and conversations I've had with business owners that I know, particularly in the hospitality industry, but not limited, light manufacturing too. Very much like some of these comments. I own a restaurant and bar in a rural community in Western Washington. Our state minimum wage is currently $13.69 an hour, which is what we pay our tip front of the house employees. After tips, these employees are making $25 to $35 an hour. Not bad for a job that requires no formal training. We start our back of the house cooks at $17 an hour and up. For full-time employees, we also offer health insurance. And we're still having major problems finding employees. I have ads for employees that get zero responses. I'm not alone in this. Everyone in our area, Western Washington, from Costco to Walmart to all the construction companies, which pay very well, can find help. In all my years, I've never experienced a labor market like this. My anecdotal experience from talking with local individuals is they're enjoying the paid time off and have no plans to come back until the bennies run out, the benefits. So for those of you who think you can just pay more and raise prices by a nickel, you're out of touch. As a point of reference, the 2020 minimum wage increased from $12 an hour to $13.50. The increase in cost to my business based on 2019 hours was $65,000, which is most of my profit. Then COVID hit. And this restaurateur goes on. Finally, keep in mind, most restaurant workers are not going to learn to code, President Biden. I've had recovering drug addicts, felons, people with other social mental disorders work for us. The restaurant business is an opportunity for many people at the margins of society to be productive and get their lives together. We give them structure, training, and a paycheck. But the big question is, how can you pay someone $15 an hour who's only giving you $7 an hour of value? In the long run, you can't. And the people making the policies today don't seem to much understand or much care about that. And it questions if we got Americans that don't want to work, and perhaps for another several months until the bennies run out, then don't we need to massage our position on immigration and support legal, skilled immigration at greater numbers than maybe even the Biden administration is discussing, where they're focused on things like asylum and just accommodating anybody who's trying to break in, as opposed to something more structured to say, hey, we need, I don't know, a guest worker program.
Yep.
Do we? Declining birth rate and Americans who don't want to work. What do you do from a policy perspective? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Ken Cuccinelli, former attorney general for the state of Virginia and acting deputy secretary at Department of Homeland Security under President Trump. Ken, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So what about this conundrum? I understand it's a conundrum that's largely based on big government policies, but it's right. The conundrum. It's the thing we've done to ourselves nonetheless. So what's a sensible way to chart a path forward?
Well, even a year ago, some of us raised serious questions about, you know, how much there was this competition to give more money. You know, money equals love in politics.
Right.
And, right. And this was all for not only foreseeable, but foreseen. And here it is unfolding. I mean, I think it's very important we not get trapped in a position of trying to solve a government-created problem with another government-created solution. The solution is to back out the government problem, and that means stop paying the elevated benefits. Frankly, we should be back to regular unemployment
yep.
routines anyway. Otherwise, you're literally just paying people not to work. And it's something I'm experienced with in Virginia and from before COVID. You know, I helped start an oyster business in the Chesapeake Bay, what every attorney general does, right? But, I mean, there's shucking of oysters and other types of seasonal work that rolls in. And, I remember talking to a four-generation oysterman named Lakey, who had said the same thing. He said, look, I'm paying these people this hard work. I asked him, where are the local folks? And he said, the benefits are too good. This is pre-COVID, mind you. Their benefits are too good to get them out to do this hard work, even though they would make more money doing the work. So it isn't like you match the money. Benefits that are lower priced, pay less, but allow you to stay home and seem unending, pay people not to work. And, you know, we're changing the nature of America with this stuff. And immigration is really a secondary consideration when it comes to this.
Yeah.
This is a fundamental problem in our country.
Well, I agree. It's a cultural problem. And I'm not sure that Republicans always speak to it in the best way. And part of it.
Oh, no, not at all.
And see if you agree with me on this. That part of it is, it's sort of like what we always talk about entrepreneurs. You know what? Not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. Some people just want to work 40 hours a week and be able to, you know, raise a family and get by and have a retirement and have a vacation once a year on 40 hours a week. And some people just want to get by. And if you pay, and they're not looking a year, 5, 10, 25 years down the road. And that's their right as a free American. If I just want to make enough to get by, then if you pay me to not work, then I'll take the pay to not work until I'm forced to work because I'm just trying to get by.
Right. No, I agree, Dan. And you've hit on one of my sort of pet peeves among all Republicans, including my fellow conservatives. And that is we don't spend enough time explaining how good our policies are for poor people. So let's jump back to immigration. If you flood the country with low-skilled or no-skilled illegal aliens, which is what's happening right now, you undercut wage opportunities for the poorest Americans and you depress their wages. So by that I mean they can't get jobs, and the jobs they do get are going to have stagnant rising wages because of supply and demand. I mean, you're just flooding the market. And at the end of 2019, the opposite's also true. The end of 2019, under President Trump, we literally reached the lowest poverty rate in American history, 10.4%. And within those numbers, yes, tax cuts were important. Yes, deregulation was important for the overall economy. But the poor in that data their wages rose more than everybody else. And that has hardly ever happened during years in my lifetime. And a big part of the reason that happened is we were actually deporting people and cracking down on illegal immigration so that the low end of the economic scale wasn't being flooded and their wages could go up. Now, this is at a time when people weren't being paid not to work, the problem you and I started talking about. But if you get rid of that problem and you enforce immigration laws, lo and behold, poor Americans benefit. Poor Americans benefit. And who could be upset with that?
Right. But based on our declining birth rate, which has been the lowest in 40 years, some say 100 years, and people wanting to stay at home because you collect more money staying at home, don't we need more immigration based on that or work visas?
Well, Amy, but before we can get to that, it's been until, you know, the last 3 months, it's been a bipartisan understanding. You really need to have the security situation in hand with respect to the border before you can start talking about expanding your work visas. I think that once illegal immigration is under control, that an expanded pool of temporary work visas is a very reasonable thing to consider as part of an immigration package. But you can't seriously do it while 170,000 people a month are flooding over the border, and you got an administration that literally hasn't taken a single step to slow that flow in almost 4 months now. That's just not fair to poor Americans who are already here, and particularly when what you're talking about is a population that starts its presence in America by breaking our law.
And what the one thing the administration has done, to your point, is drop ship, plan to drop ship money to Northern Triangle countries. Do you see that as just a misdirection play that will have no impact on those migrating to the southern border?
It has absolutely no impact on migration. And look, the United States, under both Democrat and Republican administrations, has worked with those Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, to improve themselves over the long term for decades, including all the way back to coming out of their civil wars, violent civil wars in the 1980s. And I mean, part of the reason they have respectable police forces today and security forces is because we walked down that road with them, and frankly, we were pushing them. They have citizen oversight boards of their police. The police don't commit violence. They actually enforce the law, and they have for decades now. And America was there for that, and we're there and have been walking alongside them to try to help them improve economic development. This administration is talking about that as an excuse to pretend they're doing something relevant, which was already going on. It was already going on. There's nothing new they're doing, and it has no effect on illegal immigration.
I wanted to get to your reaction, again, as former acting deputy secretary at Homeland Security, how you received the news of this cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline. And also, interestingly, the Biden administration, Jen Psaki, tweeting out Department of Transportation taking action to allow flexibility for truckers in 17 states with the Colonial Pipeline shutdown in terms of supply of oil and gas. And so, but there's some questions about how a major pipeline could be subjected to a ransomware attack that would shut it down in this country, and people suggesting that there seems to be something fishy about that. How did you react?
So the Chinese in particular have been scoping out our infrastructure for a long time, and this is all under private control. The government can only partner with willing companies, and most of what we can do is do sensors to observe behavior on their networks and that kind of thing. Again, in partnership. But because the private networks are exactly that, private, this is really in the hands of the companies themselves. So this looks more like a criminal actor in the same space, but let's not kid ourselves. There are a lot of entities out there getting a lot more sophisticated about how to attack, and in this case, monetize their ability to attack our now heavily computer-based systems.
So and, you wouldn't rule out...
You're going to see more of this.
You wouldn't rule out a foreign enemy then?
No, I would not. But I would not expect China to actually act like a criminal. They want to be prepared in case there's a strategic national reason to take action. I don't expect them to participate in ransomware attacks.
He is Ken Cuccinelli, former Attorney General of the State of Virginia, former Acting Deputy Secretary at Department of Homeland Security under President Trump as well. Ken, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you all.
Yeah, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and how being a business person, being an entrepreneur, particularly a successful one at a big level, is portrayed in Hollywood and in our culture. I mean, this is not a new topic. You know how Wall Street is portrayed. Gordon Gekko, Greed is Good, Matthew McConaughey, and Wolf of Wall Street.
How the f*** else would you do this job? Cocaine and hookers, my friend.
There it is. That's everybody on Wall Street. Maybe in the 80s, I don't know, but no, I don't want
to. We'll have to call Sean from Elmwood Park.
He wasn't on Wall Street.
No, he was.
I don't want to buy into the caricature, but, you know, it's you take something that is anecdotally true and you over extrapolate it to the universe, which is unfair. That's what Hollywood does, generally speaking, picks those that it finds sympathetic because they're sentimentalists and promotes their stories to the exclusion of others. Sometimes they accidentally promote something they don't intend to promote. And that's the case, our next guest argues, with 1972's classic Superfly. Superfly, an homage to capitalism, according to Richard Schinder's interpretation. Richard Schinder is founding and managing partner of Theatine Partners, a financial consultancy. He joins us now. Richard, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on. Good
morning. So we're on the cusp of the 50-year anniversary of Superfly, which is a classic, but I don't think it's a classic in people's minds the way that you wrote about it as a tribute to capitalism and, frankly, as a reproach to identitarianism. It has multiple applications today.
Well, I think that's right, and I really, I had two primary themes that I wanted to convey in the Spectator piece about Superfly. One is, as you were noting in the lead-in, that Hollywood, certainly in the modern era, seems to be incapable of casting enterprise and markets in anything other than a negative light. And while Superfly was hardly a big-budget Hollywood film, I think it's very successful in communicating capitalist themes in a cool and countercultural way, because you've got a drug dealer as a protagonist.
Right. And so so develop that. I mean, just for those who haven't seen it or don't remember, develop Youngblood Priest, the protagonist, and why, you know, and how his drug dealing in the movie, as the story is told, is a tribute to capitalists. And also, to my mind, the problem it raises about just genuflecting at the altar of capitalism.
Yeah, so really, and that sort of leads into the second theme that I wanted to convey in the piece. I mean, Youngblood Priest, he's a young black man living in early 1970s New York. We don't know a lot about his background, but we can tell that he certainly, you know, doesn't come from means, and he's got to make his own way in life, and there are these indirect allusions to, you know, to growing up, you know, fatherless and poor, but he's a cocaine dealer in a period of time where that was not only against the law as it remains, but certainly not acceptable in polite society. But he, through his own effort and his own vision, he develops a distribution network. He's looking to source increased supply and effectively push an amount of cocaine that was previously thought to be impossible through this network for one big score, so that he and his partner Eddie can make $1 million and get out of the game. And one of the points that, that comes through multiple times in the movie is that it's the only game the man left them to play. And that was that second point that I wanted to convey, which is capitalism is neither moral nor immoral. It's amoral. And it's, it, it is the most effective way of allocating resources as an economic system. And it allowed this, this person who came from nothing to succeed through through the dint of his own effort.
Right. Do they ever get out, though?
Well, they don't take the film that far. So at the end, he seems to have at least avoided harm in the sense that his supplier, it turns out, ends up being a corrupt deputy NYPD commissioner, but they don't really tell you if he gets out. So they, unfortunately, they, like many Hollywood films, they leave you hanging.
A more polished version of this story, which is based on a true story, was Denzel Washington's portrayal of Frank Lucas in American Gangster. Sort of the same, sort of the same thing at play here.
That's right. That very much so.
And the thing that I wanted to emphasize, just develop a little bit more, is that what you said about capitalism, because we treat capitalism like it's one of the faith traditions, like Christianity or Judaism, and people not looking at capitalism as a moral system in terms of how it operates. It may be the most moral of the ways to organize an economy, and I would suggest it is, because it's based primarily on cooperation rather than coercion. So there's morality in that innate to it. But in terms of the what it produces with the efficiency it provides, well, that could be something that is very troublesome, or it could be something that is, you know, very profound and advances the cause of humanity, or a combination of the two, which is what we normally get.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think because, and particularly in this era where, you know, the march of collectivism, you know, it seems to advance unchecked. I think there is a risk of caricaturing capitalism and free markets and, you know, the attendant, characteristics that, that come with them as a moral system. And I think the challenge in proposing markets as a form of morality is it's effectively applying it out of area. And what you find is when you attempt to apply market principles absent some other moral context, that that they're really not suited to the task, and it ends up freighting commercial activity with a role that it's not meant to play. I mean, woke capitalism is a great example of that. I mean, that's not what business is for. It's not what enterprise is for. You know, it's like I say, I don't go to an eye doctor for my arthritis. I don't look to capitalism to solve moral ills.
And so is rent seeking a bastardization of it. And so, you know, we sort of conflate now the well, since he was just on Saturday Night Live, the Elon Musks of the world with the I don't know, the Henry Ford, or, you know, pick your true entrepreneur. And an innovator that was done, you know, completely privately, not based on favor from the state. And what that, while that doesn't necessarily diminish Elon Musk's vision for certain things, it is still not the same thing when you have the state involved in your business as having, as not having the state involved in supporting your business.
Well, and I'm so glad you brought up Elon Musk, because I think the uproar about his hosting Saturday Night Live this past weekend is it's a perfect illustration of how popular culture has been long since been captured by the left, and how, as you rightly note, this rent seeking you know, corporatist is pilloried as this, you know, terrible human being, because, you know, God forbid he engages in commerce. And rent seeking is something that I talk a lot about in my writing, because I think, unfortunately, because we do such a poor job of educating our children, we've raised multiple generations now who have difficulty seeing the distinction between rent seeking big business corporatists on the one hand and small business, you know, individual entrepreneurs, inventors, and innovators like Youngblood Priest and Superfly. I mean, those are two very, very different things. But But unfortunately, they're all sort of, you know, covered with the same brush of business equals bad.
You know, the other thing, too, about this and Superfly, as so American Gangster, too, were a departure from it, as just about every Denzel Washington movie is. And Hollywood's so unimaginative. Let me give you an example just on topic. I don't know if you saw I Care a Lot. This is the Rosamund Pike movie about the woman who builds a business of becoming guardians to seniors. And then there was a documentary about this, corrupt practice, and particularly in Clark County, Nevada, where I think the movie takes place, if I'm recalling, where people are defrauding seniors. There's court proceedings where the person is not being represented. They get a doctor to declare that that person is incapacitated, doesn't have the mental acuity to manage their own affairs. And these vultures come in and essentially take people's assets out from underneath them. This is like a real problem going on in Nevada. Well, Rosamund Pike plays such a person in this movie, I Care a Lot, which was nominated for an Oscar in the just this past year in the recently concluded Academy Awards. And the whole like mantra, you know, her soliloquies are all about how capitalism and I get what I want, that, you know, this bastardized cartoonish definition of capitalism. But it's just so unimaginative. It's right up there with Gordon Gekko's Greed is Good, you know, Oliver Stone's offering of capitalism. But that's all they do. And they just rinse and repeat it in different forms. But they confuse, forget rent seeking. They confuse outright fraud, outright theft with capitalism.
You know, it's funny. I I've not seen that movie, but I was thinking about the piece I'd written over the weekend. And it just so happened on one of the cable stations I had on the movie from the 80s, and I'm a child of the 80s, you know, proud member of Generation X, but you may remember Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox.
Sure.
And I was thinking about movies like that and Working Girl, and there were quite a number, you know, along with Wall Street and you know, the more sort of caricatured versions of finance and capitalism in the 80s, but there were also these sort of more fun and light movies like the two I just mentioned. And even there, you know, the suit, you know, quote unquote suits that are made out to be boorish. There's nothing heroic about any business person. To your point in the movie you were just mentioning, you know, there's a conflation of commercial activity with fraud or fleecing. Like there's no notion, even when it's indirect, of, hey, business people provide a value for service. That is an intrinsically good thing. You know, Hollywood is fundamentally incapable of even, it seems, taking a neutral position on commercial activity and enterprise.
He is Richard Schindler. He's the founder and managing partner at Theatine Partners, a financial consultancy. And his piece, Can You Dig It? Celebrating Superfly, Almost 50 Years, and Capitalism. Very interesting piece. Richard, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
It's time for Animal Stories with Uncle Dan and Little Amy.
It's time for Animal Stories.
COVID, this is our first Animal Stories, I think, in about a year and a half.
Yeah, we were mourning the Chinese wet markets, but we're back to back at it. We're
okay,
feeling comfortable now, so
we can have a little fun.
Uncle Dan, Little Amy are back. Apologies to.
To the originals.
Yeah, of course. If anybody doesn't know, we're stealing it. I think it should be obvious. It's some more obvious than Joe Biden's plagiarism. This from Chicago, first up, 1,000 feral cats unleashed on the streets of Chicago to fight the rat problem. And Amy's going to feed them all in her garage.
Yeah. Well, I've had two feral cats from the Treehouse Humane Society.
Oh, you do?
Well, they've been working for 6 years now. And they do a pretty gosh darn good job.
Are you allowed to keep them that long? Don't you have to return the cats when you cat sit?
No, hole.
Oh, you adopted them from the Humane Society.
Yeah. Well, they give you a bucket, like a little makeshift condo, a blue barrel that they could sleep in the wintertime. And then,
yeah.
You know, if you choose to feed them some dry food, I reward them for their rat-killing prowess by giving them wet food at night. And then, you know, on the weekends they're on their own. They use their dry food. But they eat the rats, because I was reading this article, and it says that they just kill the rats, and that's it. No, they take their heads off. I have never found a rat completely intact.
Well, so what? Well, who cares?
Well, because, you know.
They say they typically don't eat the rats, but who cares if they do?
Yeah,
what's the difference?
It's fine. You know, you don't touch them because they're. I do not pet my feral cats.
I prefer to eat them because otherwise you have rat carcasses everywhere. Right?
I have rat carcasses. I have my rat gloves. I have to pick up rats almost on a daily basis. I pick up rats in my backyard because they bring them to you as, you know, hey, thanks for helping me out. Here's a gift.
Can't they train some other animal group to sweep up the rat carcasses? I don't know. Now, I wonder, too, if these cats can be trained to pump gas so they could displace Chicago police from the Operation Safe Pump. And Chicago police could be put back on the streets rather than pumping gas at gas stations where people are being carjacked.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not carjacked.
And then you can get Toonses, the driving cat from Saturday Night Live, to be your Uber driver. You don't have to wear a mask. I mean,
I'm all for a cat patrol. Yeah.
Well, like Chicago's considered the rattiest city in America for 6 years in a row now.
Because we have alleys.
Oh, yeah, but you'd rather have alleys than what they have in New York, but the garbage
of course.
Out front.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, if we didn't have the Great Chicago Fire, we would still be having that process. It's real simple, folks. Tie up your garbage bag and then put your garbage bag in the garbage can. Real easy. And don't leave the lid open. Don't invite them in.
And look forward for a forthcoming retrospective on Chicago's urban planning from Amy Jacobson, the history of alleys.
I'm just saying, there's...
Debris, garbage.
You want to see a rat that will make you vomit? My friend had a rat in her house. His head was here, and the rest of his body was here. The tail came all the way up to here. It's disgusting. I mean, these things grow into just gigantic creatures.
Yeah, I see them. I see them when they're put on display in any place that doesn't hire union labor.
Oh, right. No, they're not that big, Dan, but they're pretty big. And I'll tweet that picture out. And I just tweeted a picture out, too, of one of my cats doing his job.
So I thought this was initially like public policy, like we were outsourcing the rat department's job to the feral cats. But no, this is just the Humane Society's private initiative. This isn't city policy.
Okay.
Yeah. So just to be clear on that. Right. So
well, they're going to be euthanized anyway. So if you're having a problem with rats, just take in some cats. And if you're on Medicaid or Medicare...
Why should they be euthanized? Just like Hunger Games.
Just
release them all.
The house. Well, you have to make sure that they're spayed or neutered. Because if you have two cats, they can turn into 70 cats like that.
Yeah.
And if you're on Medicare or Medicaid, you can get them spayed or neutered for free. But if you're not on Medicare or Medicaid, you have to pay for it.
That's a caretaker for all of those crazy old cat ladies.
I thought they were joking around after I trapped all my cats.
Probably money well spent, probably savings on the dollar in terms of, you know, caring for elderly crazy cat ladies.
You know,
when middle-aged crazy cat ladies grow into elderly crazy cat ladies.
Uh-huh. No, I'll always have some form of cats around because they're very soothing. They're relaxing.
You sound like it. Yeah. Also, this.
They'll rip your heads off.
I've got another animal story here. This is very interesting. I think my dog Hayek has been laughing at me. I always suspected this, but now I may have some scientific evidence. Animals laugh too, according to researchers. In a new article published in the journal Bioacoustics, which I know you subscribe to, primatologist and UCLA anthropology graduate student Sasha Winkler lives an interesting life, and a UCLA comms professor took a look at the phenomenon of laughter across the animal kingdom, and they found vocal play behavior documented in at least 65 species, including a variety of primates, domestic cows laugh, and dogs, foxes, seals, mongooses, as well as three bird species, including parakeets and Australian magpies. So The animal vocalizations recorded as a noisy or tonal, loud or quiet, high pitch or low pitch, short or long, a single core rhythmic pattern. And they were able to isolate this, these vocalizations they recorded, and somehow come to the conclusion that there is playfulness. There's much playfulness in the animal kingdom. Of course, you see that. Play sounds can help emphasize non-aggression during physical moments. And when we laugh, we often are providing information to others that we're having fun or also inviting others to join. And apparently these animal species that they've identified, including dogs, do that as well. So your dog may be laughing at you.
Exactly. Yeah,
not with you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that.
And
I can believe that. I mean, I can.
Maybe we could have dogs displace the audience of The View, too, if all they need is the canned laughter.
Also, I you know, I'm a big fish person as well. Have you ever had a goldfish or won one at a fair, at a carnival?
Yes, I have had fish.
You've had fish?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Did they live long? Or?
Yeah, and prospered.
Oh, I'm sure they did. Well, in Japan, there is a company that's working on a little to-go tank if you want to take your fish for a walk. There's a bag for that now, and here it is. I don't know if you saw the... I'm not kidding you.
That's a pretty good travel
case.
Isn't
that great?
Yeah.
Because people need to get out during quarantine. You know, we saw people put leashes on cats just to get out, to walk the cat, you know, anything to get out of the house. And if you want to walk your fish, there you can put this on. It's a...
Well, I don't know.
I mean, it monitors the oxygen level.
Why is that walking or just transporting?
It could be both, but it's meant to. It's a long tube that has a transparent middle section and a handle and a gauge. So if you want to walk your fish around the corner or take it to the park or show off your fish, because so many people are proud of their fish, that you can put it in thing. But it monitors the oxygen, saturation of the water, and there's a little hole in there, too, if you want to feed your fish. You can feed your fish while you're taking your fish for a walk.
Hmm. I haven't seen a fish being taken for a walk before. I mean, I've seen like kids like have a little fish tank on a wagon and they're pulling it, like transporting it, but not really like walking it around the neighborhood, like going to play toss with it.
Well, the last time, remember the last day they allowed emotional support animals on American Airlines? I'm sure it was a big deal for you.
No, because I wasn't in on that scam like some people.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about, but me and Bunky were on a flight from Tucson to Chicago and this nice young lady walked on and she had an emotional support beta fish.
And Bunky started laughing at her.
She said, what's this all about? I said, I didn't know that you could take liquids through TSA. And she said, no, you can't. This is hippopotamus, and he's a red beta fish, and she's had him for 8 years, and she transports him with her all the time. When she goes on vacation, she brings...
In one of those Japanese cases that you mentioned?
No, she just had a plastic bag.
Just a baggie.
With the beta fish in it, named Hippopotamus. You can't make this stuff up.
Why do you need an emotional support designation for that? Well, you just carry it on. Because it's a liquid.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? But now she can use the fish purse, and she'll be just fine.
Yeah, sometimes somebody's got to do one of these ridiculous studies that I think we pay for all of them.
Uh-huh.
So you just got the nexus between like the keeping of pets and the losing of your mind. Like, when does it go from something like productive to something very dark and creepy and weird? You know, almost cartoonish. Like
hippopotamus?
Emotional, yeah. Or, you know, or 95% of the things you do, including with feral cats.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. AM 560. The Answer.
Every boy of the 80s remembers this music video from Whitesnake with Tawny Katane on the Jaguars. Now, Chuck Finley can sleep safely for the first time in 2 decades. He doesn't have to worry about Tawny Katane attacking him as she's dead at 59.
Yeah, it's the minor bump in the road. But in 2010, he said Tawny has had an amazing journey since the first time I met her.
Who's he?
Chuck Finley, he told the Daily Pilot that in 2010. Yeah. And though there have been bumps in the road, which we all experience, I could not be more proud of where and who she is today.
Didn't she get arrested?
Well, yeah, but yeah, and then it ended their marriage. Well, it happened.
The hitting will do that.
No, it was just, you know, it was a bad marriage. They had two beautiful kids together, Winter and Rain, and those two young ladies are mourning the death of their mother. She was found dead in her Newport, California home on Friday. There's an autopsy report that everyone's waiting for.
Blah.
Well, no, I mean, she turned her life around. She
was on the honor roll. She an honor roll student?
Dan.
Turned her life around.
Well, she's working on wellness and spiritual growth, according to her brother, which doesn't always happen living in the life she lived when she was younger.
Well, it does after you've been used up.
Well,
I'm sorry. I mean, I hate to bring truth to this because I know we just want to be sentimental about it. You know, I'm sentimental about it, too. I wanted to get a Jaguar when I was a teenager because she was dancing on top of it. I thought she may have come with
the Jag. Lady Gaga said, I don't know a person in the universe who didn't melt when Tawny got on top of that car. That was one of the greatest moments in video history. I wish I could steal that moment every day. That's from Lady Gaga.
Now I'm disgusted because why would I want Lady Gaga commenting on Tawny Kitaen?
She was, you know, a pioneer back in the day. She was the group. Well, she was on MTV all the time, and she was a great dancer, and she was good looking. That's why we're talking about her. She was hot.
She's a pioneer. Oh, my gosh. I know that's unintentionally funny, but it's funny nonetheless. A pioneer. Yeah, no, she's like Lewis and Clark. Pioneer.
You know who she is because you watched MTV.
Yeah, I know she was because she was cast in that video. Pioneer.
And The Bachelorette with Tom Hanks.
I don't think you know what
Bachelor
that word.
Bachelor Party.
Yeah. She was a pioneer because she was an extra in The Bachelor Party, basically. I mean, God.
Well, my very dear friend is married to her brother, and they are wonderful people. And, you know, Jordan told the LA Times, I think people can relate to people who've been broken at times, that she was a warrior. She had her demons, but she fought. It wasn't easy sometimes to get through every day, but she kept fighting, really proud of her.
Yeah, wonderful. And related stories, sort of, kind of, not a death story, but a broken story, perhaps. Nick Faldo, Sir Nick Faldo. He's got married for the fourth time to somebody who's getting married for the seventh time. Wow. Former topless dancer from the 80s, not Tawny Kitaen.
Easy.
Because she's unavailable. Is it too soon?
Well, they're burying her father today because he died. So, yeah, the family's going through a lot right now. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, the family's going through a lot.
Well, anyway, back to Nick Faldo, who, so there's 11 marriages between the two, almost 12 now.
Yeah, and she was a topless dancer in the 80s. She's been married six times. One guy she was married to twice.
She wasn't really sure if she wanted to get a divorce.
Uh-huh.
So she took him for another spin.
Nick Faldo is four times. So, I mean, so Nick Faldo is somebody who apparently...
Is she a current stripper or former stripper? I didn't.
She was a former topless dancer because she's 58 now, so it's probably a lot.
Maybe settling down.
A little past the sell-by date on the topless dancing, I suspect.
This is really love this time.
Yeah, or Nick Faldo is going to find out how much he hates his money again. One of the two things. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Remembering Nick Faldo's money along with Tawny Kitaen all week.
Thank you for making us part of your morning.
Pioneer.
She was. Why are you laughing? She's a nice person, too. Oh. Well, all right. We're done talking about this. All right. Thanks to Justin Kosick, our technical producer, and Quinn McCarthy, our executive producer. We're back here bright and early. Tomorrow at 5 a.m.
She attacked her husband.
Oh, my God. So they made amends, you guys. So what? She made a flipping mistake.
Who hasn't attacked their husband? Come on, Mike. We
forgive you men when you guys do that to women. So we're forgiving her for doing it to him. Gender bias people.
Yeah, my wife throws cookie dough at me all the time.
No, I'm not talking about you.
I know she does.
Beautiful.
I deserve it.
I hope it hurts.
I deserve it.